everybody thinks that they're going to be like the next millionaire for like a $50 investment, which is wildly appealing. Playing a game that is cybersecurity is like right up my alley. I love it.
Just like a new wave of warfare in the cyber war.
It's not cybersecurity. I think it's cyber resiliency.
Welcome, everybody. This is Tuesday Morning Grind, episode number 68. And one of the hottest topics in our industry right now is really getting into cybersecurity, cybersecurity training, all of the trends around cybersecurity. And probably no one does more around this than Gerald Osier, who's our guest today. Gerald is the host of his own podcast and show, Simply Cyber Podcast, has a whole training program around that. PhD in cybersecurity, does a ton of content. I think you might be the most subscribed cybersecurity YouTuber. That I've seen. So doing a ton of great work, great content, giving it away, doing training classes. So huge contribution to the community. Gerald, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on. I'm excited for this conversation.
Awesome. So where I want to begin is your career. Obviously, I mentioned you have a PhD in cyber. You're doing all the training. You've developed this passion on cybersecurity. But how did you get into the space?
So I'm very fortunate that I truly love cybersecurity. I find it is an incredibly fascinating discipline that never gets old. It's constantly evolving. It's very interesting. And, you know, to go back in the day, you know, I got my undergrad in computer science. I thought I was really into technology. So I thought like, okay, go to computer science. And I thought when I got my degree, all you could be was a software engineer. So I graduated during the dot-com boom and with a computer science degree, started being a software developer, fairly successful and enjoyed it. And I got audited for cybersecurity, right? So it was like the beginning of FISMA. I was working for the Marine Corps and I was confused, like why I got a poor score on this audit when I had written my code to all the requirements, which is how like software engineers are kind of measured. And I was curious, like, what was this all about? I wanted to know more. So I dug into it and realized, like, you know, authentication, authorization, auditing, business continuity, all these things. And it really like sparked a fire for me. And I wanted to learn more. And really the pivot point for me where I was like, I need to understand this was I found out about a tool. Now, this, mind you, this is like the early 2000s, but there was a tool called Saint, or it may have been called Satan and became Saint, but it was essentially a vulnerability scanner, right? You could scan an endpoint and it would tell you everything wrong with it from a vulnerability perspective and how you could exploit it. And it just blew my mind because I thought hackers would like, you know, they had all the knowledge, they had to be senior elite people, and they just found devices and popped them. And here's this tool that can make an idiot like me know how to take this thing over. And I was like, how is everything not compromised? I really need to understand this. So that kind of was the initial launch of the ships, if you will. And I went back to school. I'm a big, big advocate of continued learning. I went and got a master's in information assurance. Actually, I got a master's in computer science because I was still thinking I was going to be a software developer, which is fine because it helped me become a better cyber practitioner. But once I found cyber, I went and got a master's in information assurance, started working in the field, really, really enjoyed it. And then obviously went on to get that PhD in cyber operations. So I don't do offensive security really in any capacity. I'm a CISO essentially, kind of came up in that GRC space, done some blue. But because I find the field so fascinating and I know I won't get some of this action professionally, you know, like red team stuff, like that's why I continued on into the industry. And the reason that I do what I do, Christian, is because the way I give so much away and stuff is because it has given me so much over the last 20 years that I want other people to have an opportunity to have access to this feeling and this awesomeness that I've discovered with cybersecurity.
That's awesome, man. How did you get into like the YouTube, the content production, that element of it? Because that's very entrepreneurial. And it's also very like modern entrepreneurial in the doing training classes, gaining influence online. And that's a very unique skill set that I'm coming to realize. We're, now that we have like marketing at Risk 360, that's very distinct from the cybersecurity skill set. So how did that inclination come about?
Yeah, it's you know, I'm a very extroverted type person. But it's interesting because a couple years ago, I would never have thought I would have created Simply Cyber or anything like that. So I worked at an academic medical center for about 6 years, and I worked with this individual named Steve Cardinal. We had the same job, and he's a really great guy. I'm still friends with him to this day. And he said, hey, I've got an innovative idea for security awareness training. We had, you know, a 15,000 person organization, and he said, well, why don't we start a podcast? Why don't we make it like fun and engaging to get information out? And he had experience doing podcasts, and he asked me to be his co-host. So I basically got to sit next to him for 2 years. We did this podcast and learn essentially at his elbow how to do a podcast. Now, granted, this was audio only, but the idea of recording and prepping and scheduling guests and post-production editing, which is an art all into itself, and releasing on platforms and social media broadcasting, like, I basically went to like a 2-year training with this guy, Steve Cardinal, who had all the experience. So Steve left the company. The podcast closed because I didn't want to manage it by myself. But I had all these tools now. Like the idea that I could do a YouTube channel was very much within my reach now, right? And I said, okay, like I want to do the YouTube thing because with the podcast, I was confined and constrained by the policies of my business, my organization. There's certain things I couldn't talk about. And I said, I want it to be on my terms. So I started Simply Cyber. I had access to a camera and a recording, a microphone, and I just hit live. And you know, the nice thing is I'm real that I have flaws and that I'm make mistakes and my voice has different inflections and I flip out about certain things. But that's okay. I just lean into it. So for me, I just hit record and talk about whatever it is that I'm super excited about that moment about cybersecurity. And then I push it to the internet. And the nice thing is it got traction. I feel like a lot of people are interested in information about information security, but there's almost too much of it that they don't know where to start. The way I kind of think about it is like I'm mentoring at scale, where I've been up and down the mountain a bunch of times. So I can be like a Sherpa and I can tell you the path you need to take. If you tell me what you want to get to, like what, you know, we all have different mountaintops, right? So tell me what your mountaintop is and I can curate you a list of content at this point because I have so many pieces of content to get you to your mountaintop.
Yeah, that's awesome. Who do you think, over time, you kind of understand your audience a little bit. Is it mostly other cybersecurity professionals that listen in, or is it people trying to get into cyber? Is it, you know, random people that aren't in this community?
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's an interesting question because understanding your audience is definitely something that podcasters like you and I want to do because we want to serve our community as best we can. My community has evolved actually over time. So at the beginning, it was a lot of this is a certain topic or this is how you break in, these type of questions. And the audience was really people trying to break in. And it wasn't just college grads. I originally thought, like, stupid, that's what the avatar was of my community. But it wasn't. There's people transitioning out of 20 years in the military. There's people who are working in accounting that literally hate their job every single day and are looking for an alternative. So it was these break it in. Now, I've been doing Simply Cyber for over 2 years now, and a lot of the community, having been part of Simply Cyber, have broken in, and now they are practitioners. So the community shifted, but the people in the community didn't change. They literally got the job, and now it's attracted other people. And I will say that my type of content has evolved over time also. Like, telling people how to break into cybersecurity, it's important, but like I've done it so many times that I have multiple pieces of content I can point to depending on what your circumstances are. And now I'm really tailored to helping people be better practitioners at cybersecurity. So for example, I used to do a video every Monday and now I do one every other Monday, but I also do a live daily threat briefing every morning at 8 a.m. And if you're a practitioner, you really should be staying informed on what is going on in the world because the industry changes so frequently. So I was doing this threat briefing by myself every day and I thought, well, this could be useful for other people. So I just hit record and now there's 100 practitioners that join me every day in the morning for this threat briefing. It's cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's a great segue into like, let's talk about some current events. I think the one that's probably still mostly hot is the Okta thing that, mm-hmm. that happened. And if you're listening to this and you're not up to speed on that, so Okta had an incident and they were fairly public after the fact on what happened. I think I saw on LinkedIn that their head of security posted a blog post and posted about that. What's your reaction to that? The way they responded, the transparency, what grade would you give them or what thoughts do you have?
Well, honestly, you know, they also came out and said that they should have done better because they actually were compromised in January and knew about it and waited until the end of March, whether it was to hope it would blow over or maybe it wasn't as big a deal as it was. So I think that they could have done better with that. In the current climate, you know, being 2022, businesses are going to get breached, right? We hear about it. It's like daily news, like several businesses getting ransomware or HIPAA violations or whatever it is, right? So for Okta, for example, to get compromised, like, yeah, it stinks, but own it. It's unfortunate. They're our publicly traded company. They did take a dip in value when they published, right? So chances are that there may have been some decision-making around the business values being made on whether or not to go public when they did. But I think it's so commonplace now that most businesses recover their whatever market dip they may experience. And then there's a greater commons, what's the word I'm looking for? There's a greater commons obligation for an organization like Okta that is doing federated authentication for Fortune 500 companies to disclose that there was an issue because you're really exposing your customers to potential compromise, right? They said publicly, only 2.5% of our customers were affected, so don't worry about it. Well, my argument to that is like, what if I'm part of the 2.5%? Like, what does that mean? Like, I'm collateral damage and that's okay. So, you know, bad things happen. And I just feel like the faster people know about it, the faster you can do something, right? So it's like, I don't know if you have children, Christian, but like if your kid does something like the toilet's overflowing or they broke some glass or something, like, yeah, you're going to get in trouble, but like, tell me about it because it's going to get way worse if you don't. And that seems to be, there's like a correlation there with big businesses and their breach responses.
Yeah, we have a lot of clients. Like a lot of what we're seeing is if you look at contracts, because of GDPR and because of security clauses, there's either you have to notify me immediately clause mm-hmm. in there, or you have to notify me within 72 hours. And then there's like, you got to let the public know because you're doing PR. So there's a lot of this going on, but there's still companies very hesitant to release the news because of the fear of, you know, bad press or losing customers. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's becoming so commonplace that it's almost like old news. So unless someone huge like Equifax or Okta is breached, it really doesn't even make the headlines. Mm-hmm. How do you think that's going to impact the environment? And what I mean by that is, like one of the main things that security practitioners use today to try to encourage companies to invest in cybersecurity is like, you don't want the breach because you'll get the bad press. But if it kind of becomes a norm, you know, do you think that takes away some of the stick element of it? Or where do you think we're at with like getting companies to actually take cybersecurity seriously?
Well, okay. So I will tell you this, the impacts of a cybersecurity incident, right? Like you work in GRC, you're always trying to understand what are the impacts, right? And some of the categories are, you know, financial impact, reputational harm, you know, these type of kind of buckets. And we say reputational harm is a thing, and you do see the stock dip and go up, and it is kind of commonplace. I would argue that the reputational harm never really resonated with the executives. When you tell them that we're going to look ugly to the public, that, you know, it didn't translate to action or behavior modification to the executives, at least in my experience. I've never seen it.
I agree. It hasn't in mine either.
Yeah. But I will tell you, and for anyone listening to this, the number one thing that you could possibly ever do to influence or adjust behavior of leadership or an executive to support you is to speak in dollars. If you can show them that a ransom will cost $4.4 million to Colonial Pipeline, or that you will suffer a $250,000 fine by HHS OCR, here's a classic one. Ransomware threat operators, they will get in your environment and understand your business and look up what your annual revenue is. Then they will make the ransom 5 to 7% of whatever your annual revenue is. Expensive enough to make it worth their while and maximize their opportunity, but low enough where the business is seriously going to consider, if not automatically, pay the ransom. So if you say, can you handle 7% of annual revenue just disappearing? Is that okay with you? Like, I mean, obviously don't say it so flippantly, but my point is, if you speak in dollars, business people, that's what they speak in. They understand dollars. They're in business to make money. And if you're talking about losing a quantified, you know, specific dollar amount, you will have their ear. Now, you may not convince them to give you money, but you can definitely get their attention with that. And then I'll also say, Christian, you know, we've seen this time and time again. This is a nut I haven't quite cracked, but you will see a business spend $500,000 following a breach, but you can't get them to spend $50,000 before the breach, right? They'll spend 10x in a knee-jerk reaction to, I don't want my hand to get burned again, so we're going to buy oven mitts, versus saying, hey, if you give us 50 grand, we can buy an oven mitt now. You know what I mean? So that's always an interesting challenge. But again, it always comes back to dollars.
Yeah, I feel like there's some cognitive dissonance or something, because everyone tends to have this feeling that, like, it's not going to happen to them. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do you really judge? I had a conversation this morning on, like, risk management, and we were doing the impact likelihood thing. And nailing down likelihood is really difficult. And I think most companies err on the side of, well, it probably won't happen to me, or maybe I'm betting on it not happening. And in many cases, they're probably right. Maybe it will never happen, but for many companies, it will. So trying to convince a company to invest in cybersecurity is difficult. But also at the same time, like, from my experience, I feel like there are a lot of companies investing a lot of money in cybersecurity. I don't think anyone's going to make the argument that Okta wasn't investing a ton of money in cybersecurity, mm-hmm. yet they were still breached. So, like, what do you think is missing? Like, do we lack the technology? Do we lack the know-how? Is it just a cat and mouse game of inevitability where bad guys can get in if they put enough time and effort? Like, how do we fix this problem? Like, that's the frustration I feel sometimes.
Well, it's a multifaceted problem and solution. So, so a couple things. One, I agree with you. Okta was most likely doing a lot of good cybersecurity stuff. And that's probably why they should have come out right up front and said, like, listen, we've been breached. We have great security posture. They found a way in. This must be an advanced threat actor. Like, we've contacted the FBI. We're doing all the things that a responsible organization should do. You have to understand, and this is something that people who are new to the industry don't get right away. Like, you cannot be 100% secure. That is not possible. There is always going to be some risk. And getting back to money, there is diminishing returns at a certain point with investment in cybersecurity, right? So if you have, you know, a $200,000 SIM and a $200,000 firewall and a $200,000 DLP solution, right? If you've got all these things, like throwing another $600,000 of appliance in does not double your security posture efficacy, right? It's not a one-to-one linear map of dollars to security. It's more like a logarithmic curve. And as you start reaching a point where there's no value, no additional security you're getting for your investment. So you will have that delta. And this is actually why GRC is a job, in my opinion. The GRC person, specifically around risk, should be analyzing what are the risks to the organization based on based on industry, based on size, based on geopolitical elements and a couple other factors. What is the risk to that organization? And then what is the most optimized way to reduce that risk for a certain amount of dollars? And then basically take action on that, prioritizing your risk reduction controls. Now, one term that I have like been a champion of, the term cybersecurity is so ingrained in our society that there's really no usurping it. But I am an advocate behind closed doors of the term cyber resiliency. I think it's not cybersecurity. I think it's cyber resiliency. You have to plan and prepare and build your program to be able to handle when you get an incident, right? So like when you get breached, when you're Okta and you get breached, you need to be resilient to continue business operations while handling that breach, right? So like when you're in a boat and you take an iceberg hit, right? You need to be able to cordon off that part of the hull, continue driving the boat and be able to bail water out and patch the hole and continue going without ever slow. Maybe you slow down. Maybe you do a little less speed. Maybe you make a little less product, but you need to be resilient. If you take on an iceberg hit or a ransomware attack and your entire business goes down, I would argue that that's where you have failed. It's not that you were compromised. It's that you weren't built to handle when you get compromised.
That's a fantastic point. You see, the only time I really have seen that word is there's like a couple of government notices and things like that. They'll say build some resiliency in, but I think that's a great point. The other thing I want to talk about is I'm fascinated with what's going on in Russia and Ukraine, and not to downplay, you know, the very real human problem going on there. Mm-hmm. But if you look at this from a societal perspective and historic perspective, there's a podcaster I really like called Dan Carlin that does this podcast called Hardcore History.
I love Dan Carlin.
Yeah, he's great. And he has this skit on or this talk about World War I, and he talks about how the machine gun revolutionized battle in World War I, because before World War I, it was kind of, you know, the classic battlefield, you know, two armies on a battlefield who wage war. And then the machine gun changed all that, because you can imagine if you add a machine gun to battle and you're on this open field terrain, this is a huge loss of human life. So they had to rethink a lot of the techniques of battle at that time. And then World War II, there was nuclear weapons that changed the game again. But now we're seeing, you know, Russia, Ukraine, and there's a few phenomena. There's this, I would say, crowdsourcing of war. That's kind of the word I'm using in terms of ability to use social media and digital media to sway public opinion one way or the other and get other countries to act. You see that each country is using cybersecurity in tandem with physical warfare fighting, for example, attacking a power grid or something on the way in as they invade. You see, you know, attacking critical infrastructure. And this is just really interesting to watch. It's like a new wave of warfare in the cyber war. And then in tandem with all that, we're doing things like metaverse and crypto and, and all these emerging techs that we haven't really come up with the vocabulary of how we should secure these things and that kind of thing. I say all that to set the groundwork for like, what trends are you seeing? What is interesting you right now? Where are you dedicating your time? How are some of these trends going to impact, like, what's next for cybersecurity?
So a couple of things that are interesting to me about all of this. So regarding the Russia-Ukrainian conflict, like, I was convinced before February that the next, like, major global, you know, theater war would be a cyber war, right? Like, I hate the cliche term, but one that people use is, like, cyber Pearl Harbor, right? There would be some devastating cyber attack that would just cripple the adversary. I was quite surprised that, yes, there was some cyber, you know, open volleys with denial of service attacks on government agencies and stuff, and wiper viruses that were wiping machines. But by and large, this has been a very kinetic, old school, soldiers with weapons marching on city type attack, rockets into buildings. So I'm actually quite surprised, actually, at the level of what cybersecurity has been involved with. Now, the crowdsourcing, this Ukrainian IT army, as it were, I do find that also wildly interesting for various reasons. One, I think it's interesting that you can use crowdsourcing to get an army stood up like that, like a cyber militia, effectively. And it's good. Although I thought more about this too. I think it's incredibly dangerous, right? Like, you're asking people who really don't know, like, I'm sure there's people who know what they're doing and are highly motivated, right? We saw Anonymous do very successful attacks, but you've also got people who really don't know what they're doing, who don't know how to like mask their IP or use the tools that they're actually using, just trying to fire over and help Ukraine. But they are taking guidance and action from somebody on the internet. So it's completely possible that that leader on the internet is giving you Ukrainian assets to knock over or United States assets within the United States, right? Like, you're think you're doing the good work, but if you don't know what you're doing, you can seriously misfire, be led astray, or even compromise yourself to something worse, right? I've even heard of people who are, you know, think that they're helping and they're downloading malware because threat actors are like, hey, like, this is an easy target, like anything else, right? Like the Olympics or anything else. Like, this is a hot button topic. People will do what I tell them to do in order to be part of the movement, right? So, you know, your mileage may vary on how good it is an idea to crowdsource people. Now, as far as the crypto and NFT space, I agree. This one is, because of the money involved and because of the stories like Bored Ape Yacht Club and CryptoPunks, everybody thinks that they're going to be like the next millionaire for like a $50 investment, which is wildly appealing. But dude, I spent a couple $100, got on an NFT train, like went through the whole process, got hyped about the project, like knowing that this was going to be like lost money, okay? Got hyped about the project, felt FOMO that I wasn't going to buy more of these NFTs, and learned about that whole space. I felt like I had to have skin to learn about that space. The space is moving way faster than any regulation, any type of security for sure is happening. And I'll just tell you, there is rife fraud going on in the NFT and crypto space. And we're also seeing just today is March 30th. There was a $600 million cryptocurrency theft yesterday of some Axis bridge exchange somewhere. I don't even know what that means, but I know somebody made off with $600 million of real US, you know, well, US money in cryptocurrency. So that whole space is Wild West, Oklahoma Sooner, like, you know, territory. So I would avoid that, honestly. That, you know, that's less cyber, that's more me. Like, I did some research, it's fraud, I'm out, not my thing. Now, as far as my thoughts on where we're going, okay? One thing that I think, and please forgive the buzzword here, but like AI, machine learning, okay? And I know these models can be tainted, but I really think with the amount, this is for my blue team people, okay? With the amount of telemetry that endpoints and mobile phones and cloud systems are generating now, we're getting like an incredibly rich set of telemetry, which is what everybody's been asking for. Give me some telemetry. Well, now you've got all this telemetry and you're getting like almost like telemetry overload or analysis paralysis, where SOC analysts are getting burnt out because they're getting so much information and so many false positives and fatigue around, oh my God, like, should I work this or not work this? Is this serious or not? So I believe that there is a great use case for AI, machine learning. I'm not talking about like iRobot sitting next to you at the NOC. I'm talking about intelligent kind of, not orchestration, but enrichment of that telemetry, or the correlation of that telemetry, where it abstracts it up a level. So instead of looking at raw telemetry or, you know, IPs and stuff like that, you're getting a more connected vision because of the computer assistance, frankly, to make SOC analysts more effective. And I could see it translating to the red team as well, right? Where you use AI to kind of knock out a lot of those common findings, like the stuff that experienced pen testers get, like, just like they sigh. They're like, oh God, like this is so boring. Like, I hate doing this part of the job. I like finding novel 0 days. So I see AI and ML getting like more mature. There's certainly a ton of research, both academically and in the private sector, around making that capability more marketable, more explore, more useful, have more utility for society. And I think that there's a great use case for the cybersecurity industry to level up its game and assist analysts, not replace analysts, with this type of technology.
Yep. You were mentioning crypto. The direction I thought we might go is decentralization too. So I've been thinking about like the problems with the modern internet, and some of the stuff that you just mentioned is like the openness and interconnectivity of the internet, which is its biggest strength, but also in some ways from a security perspective is weakness. So is there opportunities with like decentralization and kind of what they're doing with blockchain? And I've seen, I think Protocol Labs has Filecoin, and they have like this decentralized data storage solution. So it's like a data center alternative that's based on decentralization. Is there like opportunities to slightly re-architect elements of the internet that are more secure? And I don't have any answers or really even a question here. It's just like, I wonder if there's something that we don't see yet that's going to emerge that is just inherently a more secure version of like the internet applications doing business online, the way networks are constructed. I don't see anything happening, but maybe there is.
Well, I mean, I could see a couple use cases, right? So I'm not sure about decentralized, but when I think of the blockchain, I think of an immutable record, right? So that's what a blockchain is. For those who are not familiar, it's basically like a ledger that records something that can never be modified. So in our industry, you know, audit and accountability is very, very important. We need to be able to forensically understand what happened, and we use logs to do that. So I could see one instance where you're using a blockchain to essentially immutably record what is happening, what users are logging in, what IP addresses are they logging in. Now, usually blockchains are publicly viewable, right? So you'd have to be very careful as to what you're doing or what you're publishing up there. But I could see some instance of that. Also, if you're able to, I don't want to say privatize, but mask a blockchain, so almost like a private sector blockchain, I could see instances where you're putting data there. Like, for example, this is almost like a dream idea, but or a utopian idea. But like right now, like the patient medical record, at least in the United States, it's very difficult to move it around, right? So I go see a chiropractor in Dallas, and I see a cardiologist in DC, and maybe I get my teeth cleaned in Savannah, right? Like there's no unified record. If I want to be able to share with my general practitioner my experience with my cardiologist from 4 years ago, I've got to like remember who the cardiologist was, call, hopefully they're still in business, get my records maybe faxed. So it's a real dis kind of disjointed system, right? And this is just one use case, but just think of it as like data that would be very practical, very valuable if it was centralized. So if the blockchain, if there was like a Jerry node on the blockchain or some fork of a Jerry blockchain for my medical record, that instead of the cardiologist saving it in their EMR, they could write it to my blockchain node, then my medical record follows me no matter where I go, no matter what I do. Now, this would require interoperability across all these different healthcare providers, the ability to interface with my blockchain and read from it. So there's a lot of, you know, protocol, like the strategy sounds good, but operationalizing it, again, it's more of a dream sequence. But I could see instances like that being practical and useful.
Have you heard of Mastodon? Which is like a decentralized, so there's a decentralized social media platform where basically you can, like you could have your own individual instance of a social media site. I could have my own, but they operate off a common set of protocols where you could federate with each other. Mm-hmm. So I could allow you and me to communicate, and then we could now share data. And then, but at any time I could retract that federation and own my own data and delete it from your systems. So that idea kind of sparked the same idea you just mentioned with like sharing medical records, but it still requires a common protocol or a re-architecture of like the internet or whatever you want to do to be able to use that. and we're pretty far off from mass adoption or something like that. But it's nonetheless interesting, and Mastodon has a pretty big user base. Let's go to what you're doing with ThreatGen, like the gamification stuff. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I actually just took a new job not too long ago with a company called ThreatGen. They are a cybersecurity simulation platform provider, and they're also doing cybersecurity educational content. So my role there, I have two roles. One is director of cybersecurity education. So I'm responsible for developing all of the curriculum and kind of the strategy of where the curriculum goes. And I'm also the information security officer for the organization. So what that means is I get to practice cybersecurity, which is part of my desire. And I get to do this education. Now, what's really interesting about ThreatGen, and part of the reason I took the job, was they have this simulation platform, which allows you to either behave as a blue team or behave as a red team. And you have some environment, right? So it can be like a healthcare facility. It could be an oil and gas pipeline manufacturing facility. Like, there's different ideas, right? Corporate infrastructure. And let's say you're going to play as the blue team. You can just play the game to play the game. And you start day one and there's an active adversary, AI controlled or human controlled, on the other side, who's going to try to attack you, right? I'll be the blue team this time. I get to decide, like, do we need policies and procedures? Do we need security awareness, multi-factor? It abstracts it up at the strategy level. So I don't need to know, like, how, what SIM we're going to use or how a SIM works. I just need to implement a SIM, right? And now by implementing a SIM, I get access to incident response processes and these other things. And within the platform, you can, like, learn more. Like, say you're a beginner or junior level analyst, you could click on, like, install a SIM. You could click on it and it will tell you, like, what a SIM is, how does it fit into an information security program. Very useful. So this is just the simulation platform if you were going to play it straight up. What is the next evolution and why they hired me is because I'll be developing educational content. For example, like, let's talk about phishing an end user, right? Very common, simple scenario. I can tell you in a lecture, like, this is how phishes come in. These are the different angles, right? They could be malware with a macro in an Excel spreadsheet. It could be a hyperlink to a landing page. Whatever it is, this is what it looks like, et cetera. Now let's hop into the simulation and actually see what this looks like when the network gets attacked. And we can build these custom labs in the simulation. So instead of playing it from kind of beginning to end in, like, a fun, entertaining, and educational way, you can set up just this lab and be like, all right, you're on the blue team. An end user in your environment just received a phish from the threat actor. They just clicked on it. This is, like, what's happening. You can see the actors now got in and they're moving laterally to these other endpoints. This is what happens. So you're kind of safely educating the end users on what happens when incidents occur without actually compromising an environment, without actually really having any risk. And between the theory or lecture and the practice, you're really able to connect the two and engage the learner at whatever way works for them, right? Some people are doers, some people are readers, some people are listeners. We kind of attack all facets of that in order to ensure that the student is getting the education that we're trying to deliver to them.
It sounds like we do a lot of tabletop exercises. It sounds like a really interesting way to do a tabletop. Who buys it? Like, is it cybersecurity professionals? Is it students? Who's
right. buying Well, great stuff? Question. We actually do have clients that use it for tabletop exercises. And we'll, for those particular instances, we'll build the environment to map to, like, their corporate environment, their kind of naming conventions and stuff like that, and use it for facilitation of the exercise. There's basically four types of consumers of ThreatGen's solution. One is kind of the obvious one, and you already said it, the cybersecurity practitioner. So before I even worked there, in fact, this is how they found out about me. I bought the product and was live streaming it on Simply Cyber. I love cybersecurity, as I mentioned at the intro. So, like, playing a game that is simply that is cybersecurity is, like, right up my alley. I love it. So there's the practitioner, right? There's also educators. So we didn't mention this, but I'm also a university professor at the Citadel Military College, and I teach in the cyber sciences department, and I use it, and other faculty at universities use it to educate their end user or their student population on, like, this is what a blue team is. This is what a red team is. This is what network infrastructure looks like. You know, I told you, you can click on the button and self-learn what a SIM is, but it's a lot more effective if I click on it and I give rich context as to why I use a SIM. What, you know, depending on the class and the situation, maybe I talk about different SIM solution providers and pros and cons of each of them and stuff like that. Also, we have CTFs. So organizations like conferences and stuff will engage with us in order to host and run a Capture the Flag tournament. I didn't really get into this, but there are like leaderboards, scoreboards. It is gamification. So in addition to playing a game, there's also like badging, prestige, unlocks, you know, those type of things. So we can leverage it for CTFs as well.
That's awesome, man. Well, Darryl, man, I appreciate your time and tell me educating the masses and all the work that you do on the free content that you provide and for being here. If you guys want to check out Darryl's work, check out just Google Simply Cyber. Look up Simply Cyber on YouTube. You'll also see a ton of content that Darryl's producing. Darryl, thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. And Christian, if I may, can I share one last thing that I think would have huge value for your audience?
Absolutely.
About 2 weeks ago, I actually developed and launched a GRC analyst course. I call it the GRC Analyst Masterclass. And this class, like when people ask me, where can I get GRC training? Like there's tons of red, tons of blue. I never had a good answer for where to get GRC training. I would literally tell them, go read NIST, which is like a reference and not really a great practice for non-practitioners. So I got fed up with a crappy answer. So I just made the course, right? Why I want to share this course is designed for anyone looking to get into GRC or learn more about it. So you might be a SOC analyst and you want to learn about GRC. And the cool thing is I made it a pay what you can model. So it retails for $49, but like literally you can pay $0 if you want. And tons of people are doing it. And that's absolutely cool because I'm interested in getting this information and education out there. I don't need anyone to explain to me why they are going to pay $0. I don't want to know. A lot of people have reached out to me and told touching stories about how it being accessible to them because of this is going to change their life because they have three children, they're a single mom and they work nights, and there's just no way that they're going to be able to afford anything to change their situation, and how this is actually the spark that they needed to drive them. So if anyone is interested in learning more about GRC with absolutely no barrier except your own time keeping you from doing it, I would implore you, like Christian said, you know, I'm all over social media. Simply Cyber's everywhere. But come check out that course. You can get it at simplycyber.io/courses. It'll just redirect you. But I am particularly proud. It's only been in place for 2 weeks and we have over 2,100 students, 1,500 that are actively taking it. So it's been wildly popular.
That's awesome, man. Congratulations and thank you for doing that. If you're listening to this, I'll include that link in the YouTube video or the podcast link, wherever you're listening or watching this, so you guys can get to it easily. That's great stuff. I get asked the same question a lot. Where can I get GRC training? So here you go. I have somewhere to refer them.
Awesome.
Well, Darryl, thanks, man. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for watching Tuesday Morning Grind podcast. If you like content just like this from cybersecurity executives, thought leaders, hackers, then come on over to risk360.com, check out our resource center, where we have blog posts, white papers, videos, all for free that can teach you about cybersecurity. If you want to know more about cybersecurity certifications like ISO 27001, SOC 2, PCI, HITRUST, and others, we have a ton of content on that. So whatever you're looking for, we have a lot of resources. Head on over to risk360.com, shoot us a note, and we look forward to keeping the conversation going.